young people decided to form their own organization called the Guardian Angels. You see them with red berets. When you see them, you get a nice, secure feeling in your heart.
I admire Curtis Sliwa, and I think that he takes his life into his own hands doing what he does.
Curtis Sliwa, the Guardian Angels founder and leader.
We've got Curtis Sliwa from WABC Radio.
Curtis Sliwa, legendary New Yorker.
Drive at 5 with Curtis Sliwa. What happened today? Why? And what's next? Live, local, on it. 77 WABC.
Seven minutes after the hour of 5, this is your Drive at 5 with yours truly, Curtis Sliwa, set to take you wherever it is you're going. As you leave your 9 to 5 and you check back with us on your terrestrial radio, your streaming audio, your app, by whatever means you listen to this program, or maybe you'll be copping a squat and listening to it later on a podcast format. But at the start of the day, the president, who now has officially acknowledged to everyone that this is how he communicates to us White House policy, tweeted away that he was nominating a brand new FBI director to replace James Comey, who will be testifying up on the Hill at the Senate Intelligence Committee starting tomorrow. That person is Christopher Wray. And the moment I heard the name Christopher Wray, I said to myself, hold on a second. Wasn't he part of the phalanx of lawyers who were defending Shamu El Jefe Chris Christie during the Bridgegate inquiry? And it takes me back to what Chris Christie was saying just months ago about his involvement.
Let me be really clear with you, as I was today at the State House. I knew nothing about the lane realignments before they happened. I knew nothing about the lane realignments as they were happening. I had nothing to do with the planning of it. I had nothing to do with authorizing it. And we sit here now nearly 3 years later, and there has not been one scintilla of evidence to contradict what I just said. And, you know, that's it.
On the line to discuss, and Mike Kelly, columnist for The Record. Thanks for joining us here on the Drive Home at 5 again, Mike.
Hey, Curtis. It's a pleasure, yeah. First of all, there is evidence that Governor Christie knew about the lane closures ahead of time. This evidence comes in the form of testimony from the trial last fall. But just a small point, I guess, right?
Oh, well, you know, I found him to be totally complicit in being the person responsible for calling the shots in this case of the lane closures. And yet, even though two of his minions are going to probably go to jail as a result of that,
Sure. He's
taking the code of omerta. But when I heard the name Christopher Wray, now correct me if I'm wrong, Mike Kelly, wasn't he part of the legal teamwork put together at taxpayers' expense to defend the governor from being indicted on this case?
Oh, absolutely. Christopher Wray is a prominent and well-respected attorney with some serious chops as a federal prosecutor. He was he was one of the highest-ranking people in the Justice Department during the George W. Bush presidency. He headed the criminal division at the Justice Department. But then he went into private practice, and he became a defense attorney, and he jumped to the other side. And when Christie needed an attorney, he reached out to Christopher Wray. Now, why? Of course, it's logical that anybody would reach out to get an attorney, but why Christopher Wray is significant, in my opinion, is that one of the pieces of evidence that the federal prosecutors were not able to get their hands on when they were investigating the Bridgegate scandal here in New Jersey was Chris Christie's cell phone. And for a long time, this cell phone was missing. And then last summer, it was Christopher Wray who came forward as Chris Christie's attorney and said, I have the cell phone. I'm keeping it. So here's what we have. Here's what we have, Curtis. We have the new FBI director going in to being nominated by Donald Trump, Christopher Wray. But he's the guy who blocked FBI agents from getting their hands on that Chris Christie's cell phone when they were investigating the Bridgegate scandal. I don't know how we worked that out, but if I was in the U.S. Senate, I think I would ask him that question when he's put up for nomination.
And not only that, but out of all the capable men and women out there, why would you reach in to a bag of potential nominees
right. That
involves somebody who is so closely associated with Chris Christie, who himself is tainted? That's why he's not part of the administration.
Curtis, you ask a great question there. First of all, what is this guy's, what is Christopher Wray's qualifications, other than the fact that he's been a high-ranking Justice Department official? I find I'm baffled by this. I do, however, what we've seen in President Trump is when he looks to somebody to be part of his team, he keeps the circle very, very tight. And this is why we are now hearing a lot of complaints from people who say that, President Trump simply has not filled out the various staffs in the various cabinet offices throughout Washington, that there are way too many vacancies and a lot of work is simply not getting done. So did he really have a wide net in his search for a new FBI director? We just don't know. But I agree with you, given Christopher Wray's connection to Chris Christie and the Bridgegate scandal and so many unresolved questions about that scandal, why would he pick a guy like this to head the FBI, especially at this time?
And to replace James Comey. Now, right. Tomorrow all eyes will be on the Hill, his testimony before the Senate Intelligence Committee. What are you anticipating that will emerge from that?
Sadly, what I'm anticipating is we're going to see a lot of partisanship. I watched this a couple of weeks ago with the House Committee and their hearings. It seemed to me that there were two universes here. There was the Republican universe and how they looked at this particular issue, and then there was the Democratic universe. The Democratic universe wanting to basically skewer President Trump, the Republican universe trying to defend him in some ways. So what I'm going to be looking for tomorrow is whether that partisanship spills over into these Senate hearings. If it doesn't, I think our country could be in for some good things. We might actually start to learn something about what really happened with the Russian hacking and impact on the 2016 presidential election. But if we still have these partisan focused lines of questioning, I don't think we're going to get anywhere. Vis-a-vis Comey, I think what I'm going to be looking for is a sense of authenticity and a sense of how well he's able to communicate a genuine story. Obviously, he's got some holes in his story. His handling of the Hillary Clinton debacle, I think, is questionable at the very least, and a potential sore spot for many, many people, justifiably so. But I think how he handles those kinds of questions, I think will go a great length to whether he's credible or not.
Well, other than Mike Kelly, whether he told Trump on three separate occasions that he was in the clear in the investigation, which apparently in his initial statement he is going to contradict,
right,
or he was being asked to take a loyalty oath, I think where he has to be put under strong cross-examination, and it'll probably come from Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, is, you mean to tell me you went out days before the election, held a press conference based on fake news that had been created by the Russians, alleging that the attorney general at the time, Loretta Lynn, had actually promised that there would be no prosecution of Hillary or any of her Clintonistas, knowing that was fake news? Now, how the hell does he answer that one?
Well, again, this is there are holes in his decision making, and I think how well he's able to explain that, and I don't know how he explains it, quite frankly, Curtis. I think it's a problem for him. But we're dealing with disinformation, we're dealing with false information, and in the middle of this, we have an FBI director who's trying to decide whether or not and how to discuss publicly the potential indictment and charges being filed against a presidential candidate, namely Hillary Clinton. We've never seen this before in the history of our country, and so hopefully we'll never see it again. But how well Comey is able to explain this, I think, is going to go a long way to helping this country understand what exactly happened last year for, during the presidential election vis-a-vis the Russians.
Now, Mike Kelly, as you know, James Comey has a split lineup card. Grew up initially in Yonkers in Westchester right. County, and then the rest of the time in New Jersey. So if he comes out like a hero in the aftermath of his interrogation, you'll probably claim him as New Jersey's son. If he looks like a bum, you'll probably say, you see, that's what you get when you're lost in Yonkers.
No, I think he's very much associated here, not only with New Jersey, but in particular with the small Bergen County town of Allendale. He's very well known up there, very well respected. I went up there a few weeks ago and wrote about him. And from the perspective of his hometown, I'm going to be up there tomorrow watching the hearings and writing about it from the perspective of his own hometown.
Well, if you happen to be with his dad, who recently called Trump, he's a lifelong Republican, I might add, his dad,
sure.
called Trump the nut job, not his son.
Well, his dad actually did that in my column. I was the one that quoted him
yeah,
on that.
Yeah.
His father was... And his father went on to say, listen, I'm a lifelong Republican, but I did not vote for Trump. So there's a lot of anger by bedrock Republicans in Allendale toward Trump and the way Trump has treated their hometown hero.
So this would be great. We're going to be following your column, Mike Kelly, in the record, as you'll be in Allendale with James Comey's old man who calls Trump now the nut job, while you're following the Twitter feed of response from the president himself to James Comey's testimony tomorrow on the Hill that we'll be exclusively providing to you in radio form. You don't need to go anywhere else, with commentary coming from both Bernard McGuirk, Sid Rosenberg from 9 to 12, and then yours truly and Ebony K. Williams from 12 to 3. So you got to hear the testimony. You're going to hear the commentary. You don't need to go anywhere else. Keep it right here on 770 AM WABC.
Curtis Lewa.
Really trying to help our cause.
The Drive at 5.
We're very honored to have him here today.
77 WABC.
Sitting on the park bench, eyeing little girls with bad intent.
5:26. The classic Jethro Tull song, Aqualung, about a perv in a park. Well, just imagine the perv is no longer in the park, sitting on the park bench, but he has descended into our subterranean hell known as the subway system, the IRT, the INT, the PMT, and they are everywhere. And the crime stats in terms of the pervs who are stalking women, who are weenie waving, who are what I call fender bendering in crowded, packed subway cars, is reaching an all-time high. And in fact, it was brought to our attention by the New York State Senator for both parts of Brooklyn and Staten Island, Islands, Diane Savino. Thanks for joining us here, Diane, on the Drive Home at 5.
Thanks for having me, Curtis.
All right, so explain this, because each and every year, the transit police have acknowledged an incredible increase of pervert crimes in the subways. What kind of stats are we talking about?
Well, you're absolutely right. The number of sex crimes in the subways has gone up consistently every year. And some will say, well, it's going up because people are reporting it more. And I guess that's a good thing, right? That's what we want. We're also seeing it. And by the way, I want to thank you and the Guardian Angels, because people may not realize it, but you guys have been riding the rails for the better part of the past year to bring attention to this and to make sure that that you're a level of protection where the NYPD can't be everywhere. And, you know, you have actually made a difference in helping catch some of these sexual perverts or preventing them from acting. So I just want to put that out there right at the very beginning, Curtis. Thank you for your efforts on behalf of, you know, young women who are riding the subway. But unfortunately, we're still seeing an increase in the number of these, you know, perverts who are riding the subway. And I'm not just talking about flashers. You know, we all remember that from when we were young. You know, I think every woman who's ever been on the subway can, you know, point to a time in her life where, you know, she looked across and some, you know, somebody was exposing himself and, you know, maybe masturbating on the train. And it's something unfortunate that we all encounter. It goes way beyond that. You know, the public lewdness issue has always been there. But what we're seeing is these violent repeat offenders who are riding the rails every day looking for victims. And unfortunately, they're able to do so almost without any real penalty because the law doesn't treat them as the violent sexual predators that they really are.
It seems that when they do the same acts above ground, they end up on a registry if they've been convicted of a felony crime. You can go to websites in your neighborhood. You can find out where the sexual assaulters are. You can find out where the pedophiles are. But there doesn't seem to be a registry at all of sexual perverts in the subway who are like predicate offenders. They haunt the same subway lines almost the same time, same place. You'll find them out there. Why is that?
Well, for some strange quirk in the law, they are considered, these are considered misdemeanor crimes. And that's what I'm trying to change, to make them a felony, to really reflect the level of seriousness that these crimes are. And when you think about just how bad they are, so just a month ago, I think it was about a month ago, there was a story of that young woman, a young actress in New York City. She was accosted by one of these sexual predators. He groped her. She fought him off, managed to get away from him. Went down the stairs to the subway. She thought she was away from him. He followed her, and he pushed her onto the tracks. That's the type of predators that we're talking about. We're not, again, we're not talking about the public lewdness issue, even though, I mean, that's bad enough. But these are violent predators who know that if they do something in the subway, the likelihood is if they do get caught, they're going to get a slap on the wrist. It's a misdemeanor, and they'll be free to continue to seek, you know, their victims. Just today, you know, while I was speaking on this bill on the floor of the Senate this afternoon, there was a story, and the Daily News is reporting on it, on a young girl, 14 years old, who helped the NYPD catch a serial sex offender in Manhattan. She had been riding the train, on the number 4 train. This 48-year-old man had repeatedly grabbed her behind on the train. She took his picture, she followed him, and when she went to school, she showed her the picture of this predator to her school administrators. They notified the MTA. They were able to match his picture to the photo of a predicate felon. He had been arrested, Curtis, 32 times for molesting women in the city's transit system and above ground.
Well, we do.
The kind of people that we're trying to, you know, lock up and make sure that they're not free to continue to attack women.
Well, you certainly on this subject have a microphone of your own here on the Drive Home at 5. State Senator Diane Savino was so correct. The group that I run and organize, the Guardian Angels, we have a special unit. It's called the Perv Busters. You could go to pervbusters@guardianangels.org or Facebook at Perv Busters, Twitter at GA Perv Busters. And tonight, I'll be at 59th Columbus Circle. We've got flyers of a perv who is out at Broadway Junction, East New York, flashing his three-piece set, and he's gotten away with it. And naturally, most guys, they don't even think twice about it because it doesn't impact them. But women, they are like Bambi in the middle of hunting season, wearing an orange fluorescent vest while all the hunters are beating down on them. And in this case, it's the pervs. And we will work with State Senator Diane Savino to get a registry, so that you can go online and see who all these predicate perverts are who stalk women in the subways and go in and out of a turnstile criminal justice system that treats them with a misdemeanor offense. That's a double oofah.
Imus in the Morning.
So far, so good.
And the Drive at 5.
There are so many ways to do it.
On air, online, on the app.
That's unbelievable.
77 WABC.
Yo, 541 as we continue on the Drive Home at 5. And as you all know, this Sunday, June 11th, is the 60th anniversary of the Puerto Rican Day Parade up Fifth Avenue. As you know, quite a few of the sponsors opted out, in fact, most, as a result of Melissa Mark Viverito, the Speaker of the City Council, wanting to honor Oscar Lopez Rivera of the FALN. He says, now don't honor me, I'll just march. But the mayor has claimed that he actually fought against the Puerto Rican parade to be honoring Oscar. On the line to discuss that, Hurston Barrero, he's my partner once a week on New York One. You can watch us tonight debate the issues of the week, both at 7 o'clock and 10 o'clock. And he's the commentator and editor at large for City and State New York. Now, Hurston, is Mayor de Blasio guilty of mumbo jumbo?
He's a big, fat liar. and his nose is going to grow right out of City Hall into his Brooklyn residence. I've never seen a guy with such cojones and to be able to say things that are outright lies. Look, the first thing is, Curtis, you've been around, you've been participating in this parade. I can tell you, I've covered this parade for at least 35 years. I have a piece at City and State right now, a column. Don't blame Oscar. If you take it in the context of the way these things happen, Oscar Lopez Rivera could have stayed home. This is the machinations of Melissa Margarito, Lorraine Cortez Vasquez, and the mayor trying to take credit for something. He can't get away with it. He owns this. He owns the fact that Oscar Lopez Rivera was chosen by the board of directors, whether it's right or wrong. I happen to think he's a patriot. You happen to think he's whatever you want to think. There is, you're entitled. That's why we have opinions. The fact is that there was a trial. He wasn't convicted on what people say that he did, but let's get past that. The mayor is a liar. And then he has another liar. I wrote a column today also with City and State, which is marching orders, with Lorraine Cortez Vasquez, which is a shameful person directing. This is the worst board that I have ever seen, beholden not only to a politician tied into MIRAM, which is Roberto Ramirez and Luis Miranda, but also in the pockets. This is a person on the public payroll. She is hired as a senior advisor to the mayor, Lorraine Cortez Vasquez. She is milking, living off the taxes of New York City taxpayers. And here she is working for the mayor and having to listen to what the mayor says. So the mayor can lie all he wants. Do you think that any other politician, a good spending Puerto Rican, chair of the Puerto Rican board, the National Puerto Rican Day Parade board, would stand for a liar like this to say these, claim these things and not take them on? She can't say anything. She's got to put her tongue where the sun doesn't hit because, in fact, she works for the guy.
But now, Hirschen Barrero, I understand the mayor is actually hosting a celebration of the parade tonight at Gracie Mansion, where he's going to bust open a six-pack of the Puerto Ricans' favorite brew, Chafer, and hand it out to Melissa and all the people that you mentioned. So if he's trying to distance himself from the Puerto Rican Day Parade, why is he going to be prime time passing out the Chafer?
Well, first of all, he's not handing out beer. Second of all, that is a tradition by mayors dating back to the, since I can recall, that they do host it, and it's usually on Thursday. I'm hearing he changed the date because this way you can't go. You used to bogart yourself and, you know, and bum rush so that he knows you're on the air. We're going to be on the air at New York One. But certainly this is a tradition. Don't put that on him. I'm not going to attack him on that. But what it has changed is that there is a vetting process that has never been seen before. If they actually send you an invitation, by the way, I tweeted at Hirschen Borrero, and you can see the invitation so that everybody can call up and drive them crazy. You then are vetted, and not everybody gets in. You try to get in. The press, I understand, is invited. They can come in, but you must be on a list that is vetted by this bozo. His name is Marco Carrion from the community.
Excuse me. I want a pass for my free Cuchi Fritos that I always used to get at the Puerto Rican parade festivities at Gracie Mansion, and then at 116th Street, where I'll be on Saturday, and the parade where I used to be every Sunday on June 11th.
The Drive at 5.
Curtis Sliwa.
On the air, on the app. Curtis Sliwa, live.
My boy Curtis Sliwa.
Local.
There's a guy in a red hat.
On it.
Everybody listens to Curtis.
77 WABC.
As we continue on the drive home at 5, the mishigash in the subway continues. As you know, on Monday night, there was an F train that got stalled in between stations as it left Manhattan, Broadway, Lafayette, and was steaming towards the slope, Park Slope, which is the former residence of the part-time mayor, the dope from Park Slope, Bill de Blasio. And it's interesting because men and women were trapped for over an hour in hot, sweltering conditions with no advisories coming from the money-taking agency about why there was a power outage, why there was no air conditioning or air whatsoever that was circulating through the cars that was sealed hermetically shut, because on an F train you just can't go from car to car. And people in the stifling heat was stripping down to their BVDs, their Fruit of the Loom, and women were taking their blouses off and just barely wearing their Playtex bras.
This, in a first world country in which we expect a first world mass transit system, and it has continued to deteriorate. But the MTA is to blame there. And obviously, Andrew Evilized Cuomo, King Cuomo II, the son of Mario Faccia Brutta Cuomo, King Cuomo I, who decided to invest not in infrastructure improvement, in dealing with power outages, track problems, and switch problems, but rather in installing Wi-Fi in the various stations that make up the IRT-IND-BMT. But that's understood. But what transpired earlier today is completely unacceptable, and I cannot blame the MTA, the money-taking agency, or Andrew Evil Eyes Cuomo, King Cuomo II. I have to blame men. And that's why we came in with the theme, the 40th anniversary of Saturday Night Fever, the macho, maniacal tribute to guys who used to live in the BQE, or as we called it, the outer boroughs, before the hipsters and millennials moved in and took over that geography. And it was considered that a man's man would stand up for the women, the children, the elderly, and the infirm. And I saw earlier today where that theme that I grew up with, the responsibilities of a man to those who can least take care of themselves, had completely fallen to the wayside. I happened to be on a number B train heading towards WABC from Uptown. There was a stop, 81st Street, the Museum of Natural History. The doors were open, inordinate amount of time, but then again, we're used to these delays, these incessant delays in which the conductor comes on with a pre-recorded message and says, train traffic ahead, we are delayed. Well, there was no train traffic here, even though that cycle of reports were running to explain why we were stuck in the station. But as I looked out on the platform, I saw a sea of humanity, mostly men running for their lives. I had assumed that further down the platform, maybe shots were fired. Maybe a fire had suddenly developed under one of the engine carriages. But oh no, as I worked my way through this tsunami of fear, as people were running for the exits, dropping their backpacks and crawling over men, women, and children, I was looking for an emotionally disturbed woman. It had been described that she was wielding some kind of a metallic object and hitting men indiscriminately from one car to the next as she was begging for chump change. Well, she had escaped in the mayhem. And as I looked around into the frightened faces of grown men who had probably just come from a health club, men who had been on the treadmill, men who had been lifting weights, and I looked at all of them as they were kvetching and complaining and talking about how their lives were in jeopardy, I said, you mean to tell me you guys couldn't collectively have tackled, bum-rushed that woman, held her down until the police finally got there? Has it gotten to a situation now where grown, able-bodied men are so in fear of their lives that they run, and they run over people and turn them into speed bumps with no consideration whatsoever, that collectively, as us and we, they'd have far more power in controlling bad situations than I and me? It was a double disgrazia. It was a double shanda. Eventually, the cops got there. I don't know. They must have been pounding donuts. Nobody was arrested. The emotionally disturbed person had escaped into the ether. But I'll tell you this. It was a bad mark on men in our society today because they completely abandoned ship on that B train earlier this morning.